Hello, welcome to the Hot Episode Podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Martinez. Today we have a special guest, Jared the Dallas out of Phoenix, Arizona. How are you doing today?
I am doing fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I have an interesting story with you, and we actually met in Phoenix a couple weeks ago that I really wanted to bring up early on just because it kind of adds to like our lineage tree of how we learned real estate. But I kind of really wanted to cover this. So I took a course, me and Anthony, if everybody doesn't know, we took a course, and that's how we met. It was from Jalen White. And we met Jared in town in Phoenix, and he's like, oh, I know Jalen. We actually got into real estate at the same time. You want to tell us how that iteration happened? Because I think this is like another iteation of the real estate tree for us. So I really want to cover this first.
This was before there were gurus, you know. And this is especially before Arizona became such a hotbed for, you know, real estate investors competition. I would say Arizona is probably the most competitive market in the United States. But I mean, I started back in 2014, and it actually came about where I rented a crappy little office. Well, I guess let's take a step back. So I was in the corporate world, did that for about 2.5 years as an engineer. I quit to go out and do real estate. I'm originally from California. I moved to Arizona for my corporate job. And, you know, I've always been interested in real estate, but long story short, I quit my job because it wasn't for me and decided to go out and flip homes because that's what everybody wants to do. They want to go flip homes. But first I had to find the deal, right? So anyways, I end up flipping two homes, find out, you know, because I bought these homes from wholesalers. I bought two in the same day. To go out and flip. I had a bunch of Bitcoin money, and that's what financed my renovations. I was an early adopter of Bitcoin. But when I bought these two homes, I saw this wholesaler made 20, 25 grand a pop, and I had no idea what an assignment fee was. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I flipped those homes. It takes way too long, costs way too much money, and I make like 25 grand. But I'm looking back at that wholesaler, and I'm like, holy crap, you made the same amount of money as me. No risk, no headache, no gray hairs. I need to go out and learn how to do this. So that's exactly what I did. I rented a crappy little office in the hood and just started printing letters like all night, stuffing, stamping. And I posted something on Instagram, and this dude was following me. His name was Carlos Reyes. And he's like, hey man, I saw you're doing real estate. Like, let me come to your office and kind of see what you're doing. So he comes to my office in the hood, and he's like, dude, this is cool. Like, let's joint venture on a direct mail campaign. We'll mail them to Hispanic folks. I'll be the Hispanic guy. You be the white money partner, even though I'm not white. And we'll play that dynamic. I'm like, great. You buy the stamps. I'll print everything, and then I'll get some people off Craigslist to come here and stuff everything. And hired a bunch of crackheads, and it was bad. Like, I was 20, 22 years old. So we go out and tie up like three or four deals and make like 100 grand on this one campaign. He's like, dude, this is it. I'm going to like, and you know, he's like, I'm going to quit my job, blah, blah, blah. And so I think Jalen was on social media as well. Jalen and Alex Sines, and they kind of got in at the same time. And I remember I dropped Alex Sines off. He came and rode with me to my flips, and he's like, hey, my buddy Jalen White wants to get into this too. We went to the same high school together. I'm like, cool, bring him out. Like, more the merrier. And so like us four were kind of running deals together, you know, joint venturing, helping people close out or lock up deals. And, you know, it's so funny because, you know, everybody kind of went off and did their own thing and became extremely successful. But that's how all four of us kind of got out of the corporate or, you know, kind of the 9-to-5 and jumped into real estate completely at risk. And we just made it happen. And we really made it happen because we the most important thing, and this is what's unique about the Arizona market, is everybody is open to collaborating. Because back then, like I said, there was no gurus. So when we found something that worked, we would call everybody and we'd be all excited, like, hey, this is hitting right now. And then we all go out and do it. And then all of a sudden it would die down. And then somebody would find something else that was new. It's like, hey guys, this is hitting. And we would just share like our secrets on how we're getting deals. And that's kind of how, in my opinion, that's how the real estate residential side evolved, which is very unique to other markets.
Yeah. And one thing you said too is, who's the little godfather of that town? I can't remember his name. Sean Terry.
Sean Terry. That was the only guru back then, was Sean Terry.
Wow.
Yeah, he's good. I mean, he really, you know, he's not one of those guys who keeps everything close to chest. Like, yeah. I was going to his office back in like 2014, 2015. Like, he would just lay it all out. Like, guys, this is how you do it. And that was perfect. I mean, that really helped all of us.
Yeah. And so you've been doing this a very, very long time. You're kind of, took a lot of front end risk. How, so you're 22 when you started. How long have you been doing this now?
I've been doing this since 2014. So
10 years.
Going on 10 years. Shit.
Wow.
Decade. I'm one of them old men. You can't see the gray hairs here yet, but if you're in real estate long enough, you'll start getting them.
Yeah, I got a few. No, a decade is a long time. It's really interesting to kind of, you have like those groundbreaking stories that of early on of the struggle at 22 and doing all this crazy stuff and bandit signs. Like, those stories are amazing, but like 10 years later, it's like, what happened? What's changed? What's new? You know, and you kind of like remembering where you came from is really, it's really cool part of the story, you know?
Oh yeah. And back then, you know, it's kind of like being in high school, no responsibilities, you know, you're kind of running around, hanging out, and, you know, it's like, you know, you don't have the burden of all this risk on your shoulders like how we do now, because now we're doing very, you know, large deals and there's real money on the line. But back then it was just like, you know, tinkering around, figuring out what works. And those were the fun days.
Now, so let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now, because I think we had a great conversation. We met for dinner and we had a great conversation, but what you're doing now is pretty crazy. I do want to preface this though. You made a tweet an hour ago or so about how you're talking to the OG land guy. Can you tell us a little about that story? Because that's a very intriguing story to me, and I want to hear more about that.
Yeah, so I sent a little mail campaign to people in Arizona who were lending private. So I'm trying to add more private lenders to my Rolodex. And this guy calls me. He's like, hey, Jared, got your letter. You know, very thought out. Just come to my office. So I was down there this morning. He's probably mid-70s. He's a third generation Arizonian. And his great grandfather, I think he was like the one, like a senator here. But anyways, he has very deep lineage here in Arizona. And so he was just, we're sharing war stories, you know how it goes. And it's just so much fun sharing those things. And he's like, yeah, there's this one, you know, back then, Glendale Road. And for your listeners who don't know, Glendale Road or Bethany Home Road is like, that's like core Phoenix. Like, that's like prime area. It's like back then, everything north of Bethany Home Road was completely vacant land. And I used to own there's one McDonald's here, and Arizona is like the third or fourth fastest growing city in the U.S. Like, it's, yeah. I mean, the population here is insane. So to say there's one McDonald's shows you how far back he's been here. So, and he's like, I had a commercial building here and there and blah, blah, blah. And then one guy, you know, he's a broker. He's like, one time this guy, he showed up. He's like, hey, you know, this group, there's going to be this new city that's going to be incorporated into, you know, Maricopa County. It's called Paradise Valley. And it's going to be the next thing. And it's like, you should buy some acreage for $50. And the guy's like, dude, $50? Like, there's no roads. There's no infrastructure. No freaking way am I going to buy it in a place called Paradise Valley. Fast forward to today, acres there are selling for $2.5 million, just the dirt. And I'm like, dude, that just goes to show you, like, anyways, don't.
So I wanted to show a visual representation of where this is. So Paradise Valley is north of Tempe. And if I zoom in, it is built out.
Yeah, exactly. They're all 1-acre lots. This is, I live in Paradise Valley, and it's the most expensive zip code in Arizona. They're not allowed to have streetlights there. There's not allowed, no commercial there is allowed, no retail, no nothing. It's just 1-acre lots, no streetlights, no curbs, like very rural, but like, I mean, there's homes in there selling for $30 million. brand new. It's insane.
That's crazy. That's crazy. So $2.5 million per acre is insane.
Per acre.
That is insane. That is insane. So for everybody here that doesn't want to invest in land, I think if you're in the path of progress, you can hold on to land long enough and you're going to do very, very well, especially in up-and-coming markets like this. I saw a video recently on Twitter, and I wish I thought about it before this call, but it showed like the expansion of Phoenix over like the last like 50 years, and it's literally insane because it was just a desert town. And then what it is now is it's literally insane. So,
yeah, it's bananas. Like, we have so many headquarters moving here. I mean, I think the statistic is 100,000 people move here a year. I mean, it's nothing like Texas, but Texas is so much bigger than Arizona. But it's just an exploding market. Getting a lot of Californians coming over, unfortunately. But yeah, I'm very bullish Arizona.
So one thing this is a very developer question for me, but one thing we're always looking at is water access. What's the water issue in Phoenix? What does that look like?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's this big conversation around water here, obviously, and there's a lot of articles, you know, a year ago about how Arizona's going to run out of water, but really what it was is, so like, we're required to have a 100-year water plan, and during that year we missed that water plan by 0.5%. So you know what I mean, Arizona missed their water plan by 0.5%, and everybody was, you know how the media is, everyone was going bananas, like, oh my god, Arizona's gonna run out of water, the Colorado River, et cetera. But it wasn't that big of an impact. And this is actually an interesting statistic. We use the same amount of water today in Maricopa County with, I think we have 5 million people here, the same amount of water than we did back in 1950.
Really?
Yep. Yep, when there was a fraction of the population. Because we have water reclamation plants that recycle water, energy efficient plumbing devices, all like rainwater capture. So we use the same amount of water we did almost, you know, 80 years ago, 70 years ago.
You've gotten more efficient as that's good. That's good. Okay. That makes sense. That's very interesting. One thing I love about Phoenix is it's very modern. I feel like they're one of the newer cities that's really adapted and took on technology and like new looks. Like, if anybody's ever been to Phoenix, go to Phoenix. It's amazing. But Phoenix just looks new. Like, it's a new modern city, in my opinion.
Yeah, a lot of, you know, I wouldn't say we're at the forefront of architecture, but we're pretty close. But, you know, in a market that's extremely competitive, you got to find, especially if you're a builder, you got to find a competitive edge. And that people find that through architecture.
Yeah. So let's jump a little bit into stuff you're doing now. I saw a video of you recently. It wasn't an ad. It was you. You're building like a condo or apartments or something. And you had like, they had just put in the water utilities and the stick frames getting built up. Is that one of your current projects? Let's talk a little about that. Cause I think that's really, really interesting. And like what the outlay on that is.
Yeah. So that's a 16 townhome project. It's out in a little, not little, it's a big city, Mesa, Arizona. Yeah, it's about 30 seconds from the Oakland A's spring training stadium, like kind of downtown Mesa. The funny thing was there was a house on an acre that was just sitting in our pipeline, and it was there for like 4 or 5 years. And one of my acquisition persons, you know, finally was able to strike a deal with this lady. So we paid $220,000 for essentially two houses on 1 acre. We knew what the underlying zoning was, so we knew it was a great deal. Kind of during that time, we kind of shifted our focus, but we wanted to go out and build. We wanted to find tracts of land, build with the sole purpose of scaling the portfolio. So let's build these brand new units, let's hold on to them for a very, very long time. And that's how we're going to scale quicker. So anyways, we, you know, and I found at that time, I found my mentor, who's also a large developer builder. And, you know, we made an agreement. He's like, look, Jared, if you ever come across land, I'll help you through the entitlement process. I'll build it at this fee structure. And you really don't have to worry. But his goal is to make me a developer, which, yeah, dude, it's complicated. I'll tell you. So anyways, so at that same time, like, look, I got this piece of, I got this acre in Mesa. He's like, it's too small. Go make it bigger. So then I was knocking on all the neighbors' doors, trying to get them to sell them or sell me their land to make my site bigger. And I was successful with one guy. So I added another like half acre to the project. So anyways, the site was an assemblage of two parcels. Total cost in the land was like 440 grand. It's a good deal. It took me like a year and a half to entitle that project. Took forever. Didn't have to rezone it. Just entitlements took forever. And we broke ground about a year and some change ago. So 16 townhomes, two car garages on the bottom. And it will be done middle of this year. Total build cost is like $5 million. And then oddly enough, the Oakland A's, they want to put a master lease on the entire project and lease it out to their players.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That is interesting. And that's like the perfect model for you, because you wanted like income from it anyway. It was a long-term build for you. So exactly. if you can lease it out with like step up raises and stuff like that, especially if it's players, oh man, that's a good little that's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll see. Nothing's done until it's done, but that seems like the best option.
Absolutely. No, that's amazing. I really want to talk about that alone right there. And this is one of the things I love land as a whole, because it's very creative and you can kind of create whatever you want at the end. So you said you bought, was there a house on the other half acre that you bought, or was it just vacant land?
No, there was a house. It was like a 1930s house, old neighborhood. It was an old farm community back in the day. And so these houses were like super, super old. And I like the little pocket, because I like putting high density and kind of low density feeling areas, because it just feels more like a community, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. So you essentially push over the houses. Now you're building 16 townhomes, and it's so creative. I love land, because you can kind of create whatever you want with it. And especially with up and coming part of town like Phoenix, you can kind of do whatever you want, as long as you go through the entitlement process and kind of have a vision. Can you tell us how you met your mentor, your developer mentor?
Yeah. So one of my good buddies, and I met him right when I got into real estate. We've always stayed in touch.
Okay.
He does his own projects but his day job is he lends hard money. And I remember one day he mentioned, he's like, hey, I got this guy that I'm really good friends with. He's a builder and he builds really fast and his prices are affordable. And I'm like, huh, well, I'm trying to find that. I'm like, can you like put us together? And he's like, no, he would never meet with you. And I'm like, okay, well, and I just kept bugging him. And eventually he agreed. We met up at a coffee shop and, you know, I told him what we do and kind of got to understand what he did. And at that time, he didn't really, I mean, he's not like out to like mentor people, but
yeah,
I think he saw something in me where I had long-term potential, because his vision is eventually leaving the company to his son, and he wants to groom younger guys to have that knowledge, kind of like transfer knowledge of what's in his yep. head and put it into my head and do deals with his son once that time comes. So, you know, we laid out like, hey, this is how we're going to work together. You know, you go shift your acquisition strategy to go find these parcels. And either, you know, we'll just sell the land as is if it's a great deal, or we could entitle it and flip it to a big builder. Or if you want to build it, then this is how that arrangement would work. And I'm like, done, let's do it. And then we hit the ground running and we have three projects right now. And, you know, I'm looking for more land, but dude, in Phoenix, it's just so freaking tough. Like, you know, you got to be really savvy in this market. You'd figure like land, right? Like who's looking at land? But Arizona's Arizona. We need housing. We got all the big builders here. And like builders, brokers, investors like me, they're all calling the same people over and over. It's no longer just the brokers calling to buy land and give it to one of their clients. Everybody in the equation, they are calling. So it's tough to get a deal here right now because these sellers have so many different options.
A lot of competition, and everybody's looking for the same thing, especially where there's high density options and not a lot of land availability. Mm-hmm. Do you see land moving out in the outskirts right now pretty heavily?
Yeah, it is. It for sure is. That's the only option, right?
It's the only option. Yeah, exactly.
Because these builders, they're not going to do like a four house project. D.R. Horton and KB Homes and those guys, like they need hundreds tracks for hundreds of homes. And the only option, the only land that's big enough to do that is the outskirts. But for somebody like me, we're more boutique, which is why we haven't really had success getting more parcels, because we want to be in the city in good locations, and that land is just not available.
So, but you being smaller, you're more nimble and you can operate a lot of smaller areas. Yeah. Now, these big developers are definitely looking for like 100 plus homes opportunities. Yes. And anything smaller than that, they're just not looking at it. And this is one thing that I recently, and not that I didn't know, it just kind of like realizations hit you now that you're doing the space a lot more, is that builders' sole business is building. So if they don't have inventory to build, they're not making any money.
Yep.
You can think about it that way.
Absolutely right.
Because like us, we can always wholesale. We can do a bunch of stuff. We have a lot of different exits and creative stuff, and we can make money a lot of different ways. But builders that have big crews and big money and they're publicly traded, they can only build.
Only build. They have to build. I mean, yeah, you could throttle back the number of starts depending on the economy, but they can never go to zero starts.
Yeah, absolutely. So how long have you been in like the development side? So 10 years in real estate, like when did that transition happen to go from like wholesaling to development?
I want to say it was like probably late 19, early 20.
Okay.
It's kind of when we met. No, actually, I think it was like 2020, because like we were scaling our portfolio. And, you know, we got to a large enough size where we were like, okay, this is starting to become inefficient. And when I say portfolio, it's a single family housing portfolio.
Yeah.
And I love single family. I mean, I get, you know, people don't like single family and, you know, go bigger, go multifamily. But the tenant profile of single family homes, like you can't beat it. Like there's no headaches at all. Like, I think we have about 70, we own 70 units, 70 homes that we own personally, and not a peep. We manage one apartment building for our buddies, and it's just a freaking pain in the ass. So love single family homes. I love the build for rent model because, you know, it's you're taking a single family or townhome product and you're just making it super dense. So you get, you know, the same demographic of a single family tenant, but you get those multifamily type efficiencies because they're all crammed up in one spot. So I like that model. So I've been, I think, yeah, 2020 is when we really said, okay, let's start going down the development path.
I've never thought about it that way as far as the condos. Because, yeah, you get best of both worlds.
You get the best of both worlds. And the key is, like, these units need to have some sort of private space, backyards or front yards, because apartments, none of those exist.
Yeah.
So you want to take kind of like a smaller version of a single family home, but they all have to have garages, yards, but just like, you know, make the site plan super dense and put some amenities in there because that's what people want, right? So yeah, you get this, because if you look at, this is actually interesting, if you look across all real estate asset classes, and there was actually a Harvard study put out like 3 or 4 years ago with regards to the volatility of rents across all the different asset classes.
Okay.
Single family homes is the least volatile by like 200%. And that's across apartments, even commercial office, industrial, retail. Like, it's the stickiest and the most stable income that you could have across all asset classes, but it's very inefficient income because you have all these scattered homes, you know, pretty much. So it's a maintenance and a management nightmare. But if you put them all in one spot, that's how you create alpha efficiencies.
Shared roofs. Yeah, you kind of combine. You can do shared piping.
Do what?
Shared piping? No.
No, they're all individual. They're all metered for electric and sewer and water individually.
Okay, that makes sense.
So they turn on their own once they occupy the unit.
Ah, okay. Now, what amenities are you adding to them to make it more friendly than apartments and housing and all that stuff?
The big ones are dog parks. So obviously, you know, you have to have a pool area, even though like nobody ever uses the pools. And then dog parks is huge. Another statistic is renters that have pets is substantially increases year over year over year. So having a place for them to go walk their dog without leaving the community is extremely important. Those are the big ones.
Are you gating these at all to kind of provide security? And
two of the three are going to be gated.
Okay. Because I think that would provide, I mean, especially a little pocket community with their own little dog park, they probably want to protect their dog park, you know?
Exactly. But yeah, it's, you know, we're finding a lot of, you know, just because, you know, younger, you know, millennials, it's home ownership is just becoming increasingly unobtainable. So we're getting a lot of millennials that come in. And then oddly enough, I was golfing with an analyst from a one of the first build for rent developers here in Arizona. It's Christopher Todd Communities. They build 300, 400 home rental communities at a time, like tons of them. And, you know, I was golfing with them, like, okay, like, what's your demographic like in these things? And they said, surprisingly, a lot of retirees who want that lock and leave. They, you know, maybe they sold their home or want to be closer to their kids, but they don't want to buy anything. They just want maintenance free living. So it's like a mix between retirees and younger folks.
That's interesting. That's interesting alone, because I mean, I get that part 100%. You don't want to be cutting the grass.
No.
That's 7 years. 70 years old, you don't want to be cutting the grass.
Yeah.
No, that's cool, man. There's like legislation coming down the line about these large corporations owning a lot of these homes. Do you feel that's going to affect you or maybe those larger corporations? Maybe not you, because you're not as big as them. And this is one of the things where you're nimble. But how do you feel like that, if legislation comes on the line where they'll start liquidating these like build-to-rent models?
I honestly don't think that would pass. And the fact is, these large institutions, contrary to what, you know, mainstream thinks, they actually provide higher quality homes with better management by far. Because if you look at the pie of rental homes, institutions only own, I think right now it's like 6% of the total rental stock in the United States. So 94% is still owned by mom and pops. And mom and pops are notorious for deferred maintenance, not picking up the phone, not taking care of their assets.
Slumlords.
And I actually think institutions coming into the rental space is a good thing, because they have standards. They're put under the microscope, obviously, because they're traded on Wall Street. They provide way higher quality homes than mom and pops.
Interesting.
And they're improving the communities as well. Like, there's a lot of education that had to take place with the city and planning and zoning, because when somebody says, hey, we're going to go build 300 rental units in the middle of a neighborhood, like, nobody understood back then. So there was a lot of education and showing like, hey, look, we're an institutionalized, well-capitalized landlord, and this community is actually, we're going to manage this and take care of this way better than the next guy. and it's actually going to make improvements to your communities.
No, that's huge. That's huge. What? I had a good one for you too.
Because and also, like, I guess, you know, not to beat a dead horse, like, these institutions, their qualification process is rigorous, because a big thing with neighbors and, you know, at planning meetings where neighbors would show up and be like, I don't want rent all these rental homes, because, like, they're so used to slum. Like mom and pop, like John and Mary, you know, anybody who could pay rent, they would let them in, and they never qualified them. But these institutions, they qualify these tenants. I mean, it's tight. So you're getting a super high quality tenant, not something. And I've rented to somebody, you know, who, you know, we kind of let ones slide by. Big mistake. I understand what people mean when by definition of slumlord, like, these institutions are not slumlords.
Yeah. I just remember my question now. So I just talked to a multifamily guy, and I've seen it in another place, but have you heard anything about, like, wholesaling utilities, like internet and cable, back to if you have multiple units?
Yep.
Have you started institutionalizing any of that since you're in that model almost, even though you're boutique?
You could. There's laws around marking up utilities. However, you could mark up internet, I think it is.
Yeah, it's internet and cable.
Internet and cable. So we have a 69 single family home community that's getting built now. In the pre-development phase, we were working with a large internet provider that provides internet to these build for rent communities at a wholesale price. Like, so for example, they would give me internet for $25 a month, and then we would then go mark that up to the tenant at $55 a month and make a little spread there, increase NOI, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But kind of in the middle of the pre-development phase, we decided that we were going to sell these units one off to consumers, and we just didn't want, like, it had to be, like, the thing is the internet and the cable had to be managed by the HOA, and we just didn't want the HOA cost to be so expensive that it would defer sales of these homes within this community. So we cut it.
Okay. So this is new. This is new information. This is why it's good. So the utility, if anybody does that with the community, is managed by the HOA, which increases HOA fees to the owner. But if it's owned by a built-to-rent community, that's kind of self-managed and kind of managed that way. But if they ever liquidate it, the HOA takes over that responsibility of managing the internet.
So it works for apartments, because there could only be one owner on an apartment building.
Yeah.
But if you have a built-for-rent community, there's always the option of breaking those homes up and selling off individually.
Yeah.
So unless you plan on, and it depends on how you plat the sites, right? If you're platting them as fee simple lots, like, I wouldn't do it. But if you're doing one, if you're platting it as a multifamily project, technically, even though it's a build for rent community, I think it does make sense, because, you know, there's always going to be just one owner, you know? And yeah, like, it, like, to manage or to maintain that, you know, that cable system, you're writing annual service contracts. Only one person could service it. And they're not cheap. Yeah. But if you're, you know, if it's platted as one site or one, you know, only one owner could own it, it can make sense, because, again, you get an NOI boost.
Mm. I have not seen a single family community platted as one lot as multifamily. I have not seen
it. It doesn't look like when you're doing, like, a detached product as a build for rent community.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like a traditional 45 by 100 foot lot. It looks like more cluster product.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of little units that are laid out in such a way where it actually feels good. But yeah, out here in Arizona, I mean, we were the pioneers, just like everything else in Arizona. You know, we had Christopher Todd and we had Next Metro doing this model back in 2015. And, you know, everyone is like, what are you guys doing? Why not build apartments? But I mean, the model worked and they made freaking a ton of money. But yeah, it's interesting to see.
So I did not know that they pioneered, pioneered in Phoenix. This is one of the things where I think it's really cool. Like, you got to pay, like, if you're very local in your market, you got to pay attention to other markets, because usually stuff will adapt into up and coming markets around the same thing. So I think if you're looking to do cool stuff, look at Phoenix, because Phoenix is ahead of the curve in a lot of different ways. And if they were doing that in 2015, that's crazy. That's almost 10 years ago.
Yeah, they were the two big ones. That's all they did. And then they started like 4 years ago going into other markets. And then the model proved to be so great that the large single family institutions like American Homes for Rent, Progress Residential, they actually created build for rent divisions within those companies to literally go out, buy land, plat it as single family detached, and build it and put it in the portfolio. So now you have like these large REITs emulating the same model as a way to scale their portfolio.
Wow, as a developer. That is insane. That's actually pretty cool. That's interesting. I love how real estate, it's very creative. Like, a lot of people, they get super creative and they create new architecture, new ideas, and then if it sticks, it sticks. But it's just very creative, 100%. Exactly. I think we're going to end it here, man. What is a quote that is yours or somebody else's that you resonate with?
I like slow feet don't eat.
Ooh.
Slow feet don't eat, which means you got to be freaking on it or you're going to lose the deal.
Yeah.
Absolutely. If you're just lollygagging around, you're not getting that deal.
Absolutely. You got to be on your toes. Got to be on your toes. Mm-hmm. Stuff will slip through your fingers if you're not on it, for sure. Especially in real estate.
And I actually heard that one from Donnie Ruffin like a couple years ago. I'm like, that's good. I like that one.
All right. So where can people find you online? I know you're on Twitter, and we have equityconnect.com. What else we got?
Yeah, find me on Twitter, and I think my handle is, one sec here, pull it up.
I think it's just your name.
Yeah, just Jared Vidalis, my first and last name, and the same with Instagram.
Ah, there you go. Jared Vidalis, go check him out, equityconnect.com. I'm excited. I think Phoenix is, if you haven't been to Phoenix, please go to Phoenix at least one time in your life. I love going to Phoenix, but definitely check it out. You can definitely see, you almost see like the future of what things look like. And I think you can see that whenever you travel outside the States, but I think I've traveled a lot, and Phoenix is definitely one of those places. It's just a newer town. Like I said, you can always go to the old cities and see like the transition, but I think Phoenix is one of those where you kind of see a newer city create new product, and I think that's interesting to see. So definitely go check out Phoenix. Definitely go check out Jared. For everybody here, go like, share, subscribe. Thanks for coming on the show. We appreciate your time, and everybody have a great day.
Awesome, man. Thank you.